Considering their woeful batting average, why are we still rooting for this team? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And it's great to be back with you again today, Barry. You know, we were away from the studio for such an extended time, and we should tell people that we did try to get together and record things while we were at Camp American, and we discovered that that is a virtual impossibility.
Well, it's something about sitting down next to a lake that really messes with the broadband signal, I think, especially in the primitive and rustic environs of the camp accommodations.
Well, we actually, because of the sound quality involved, we didn't have a room where we could go lock ourselves into that gave the sound characteristics we were looking for one thing. And the other thing was, I was in every class either teaching or running the sound equipment. So by the end of the day, plus I was taking kids here and there to do recreational things, I was exhausted. So I basically caught a nap when I could. And of course, that means there'll be lots more pictures of me sleeping, which is always fun for me. Ha ha ha.
Well, that is a camp tradition, ladies and gentlemen. It's not a good camp unless we've got at least one picture of Mr. Michaels sleeping in a chair or at a table somewhere, sitting straight up and sleeping away. But he doesn't even recline half the time. But you know what, Chuck? You know, you talked about we couldn't find a room where we could be locked away. Well, I think a lot of people think we should be locked away. But I'm kind of glad, though, that people still listen to us, even though we kind of get a little on the edge sometimes.
Well, they may have a point.
And yes, they very well might. But what I said earlier in the lead-in about a bad batting average, you know, yes, it's baseball season. It's summertime. We just came past the 4th of July, which means the baseball All-Star game's coming up. But we're not talking baseball today, ladies and gentlemen. For those of you who thought you were going to be listening to a sports commentary, this isn't it. But the batting average that I'm talking about is the batting average of Republican presidents in picking Supreme Court justices who happen to be truly conservative. And Chuck, this is one of those things that you and I have kicked around for a long time discussing, because it seems invariably that every time there is a potential nominee that comes up before the Senate Judiciary Committee, who has been nominated by a sitting Republican president, the assumption is, among the great mass of conservative, Christian, and even some constitutional thinking people out there, is that that person is A, conservative, B, a strict constructionist, and C, is going to vote the right way on all the issues that are near and dear to all. However, well, if you take a look, that the record doesn't follow the hope.
No, I think we need to define terms here, because let's talk about the difference between, say, a conservative judge and a constitutionalist judge.
Well, I appreciate that differential. So, yeah, let's do that.
First of all, a conservative judge is a judge who basically looks back at past decisions, says stare decisis is the only operating principle, and simply continues to hold the line on the bad things that have already taken place and refuses to march the line back. Now, what I mean by the term stare decisis, it's Latin for let the decision stand. And it is an old common law principle that comes to us through the English common law. It has passed down into American law. You have to remember that the basis of our law is British common law. And what it was about was that once a decision had been made and it was considered to be a good decision, it was supposed to stand. In other words, the judges were supposed to be able to go to it as a reference point and use it and say, okay, this is where the law worked. We're going to use it. Well, the fact is it has morphed into this idea that once the Supreme Court has made a decision and done a judicial review, which, by the way, does not exist in the Constitution. There is no constitutional right for judicial review in the Constitution of the United States of America. We could argue that point on Article 3, and someday maybe we'll do a couple shows where we do that, but the fact is it doesn't exist. Now, a constitutionalist judge would take a look at the text of the Constitution and take a look at the law and say, okay, that does not match. That does not match the Constitution of the United States, and therefore it cannot be enforced. And that's where a court's power stops, is in the enforcement aspect.
That's right.
They can look at a law and say, we are not going to enforce, we cannot enforce that because it is our opinion. And remember, courts have opinion. They don't have the final say. They have an opinion, just as the other two branches have an opinion.
They don't make law. That's the whole key there, Chuck.
Bingo.
The court does not make any law. They have an opinion upon whether or not an act passed by Congress and or signed or approved by the president is within the bounds of the enumerated limited powers that granted to that branch by the Constitution of the United States.
Right. And judges nowadays, no lawyer, unless you go to a tiny handful of Catholic or evangelical law schools, ever looks at the text of the United States Constitution. What they study when they study constitutional law is court decisions.
That's right. They study case law.
That's right. They study case law. And that approach has been in effect in this country for about, 130 years. Before that, you studied some case law, but you also studied the text of the United States Constitution, and you studied things like existing law in the form of Blackstone's commentaries. Once you understood the basics of fixed law, then you could pass the bar. And that all changed with a man named Christopher Columbus Langdell, who came to Harvard Law School and said, we need to apply Darwinism to legal theory, and came up with the case law approach.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, that is absolutely true. That is exactly what Langdell did. And sorry, I didn't interrupt you, but a very good book for those of you who'd really want to study more on this topic is a book called God, Man, and the Law, the Biblical Principles, and is by an attorney and law professor by the name of Herbert Titus, T-I-T-U-S. Now, Titus is a great constitutionalist, Christian, and frankly, his book is invaluable, and it's one of the key books in my library, and I'm sure, Chuck, I think you have a copy of it as well.
That's right, and I think if it's still in print, we might be able to put that on our Amazon store and make it available for people.
Yeah, I think we should do that. So, in any case, go ahead and continue on with your analysis there, but you're dead right. We've changed from looking at law in light of the Constitution to looking at the law in light of the cases that have been come before it, i.e. following stare decisis, or let the decision stand.
That's right. And the reason, what we're quoting here from, or what we're basically discussing, is an article from the Washington Post. It's an opinion piece by a man named Mark Thiessen. And what he asks in the title to the article was, why are Republicans so awful at picking Supreme Court justices? And part of the answer to that is the stare decisis and the case law approach that is used in so many law schools. That particular approach makes the picking of any judge, if you're looking for a constitutionalist judge or a strict constructionist, as you might say, a construction meaning that you look at the words and say, here's what the words mean, and that is called taking a strict construction, going by what the words actually mean, not remaking the words into something and stretching them beyond their boundaries to make the law say something that it doesn't say. And that makes these ideas, the way lawyers are trained currently, makes the choosing of any judge nothing but a roll of the dice. And also, there's another problem, Barry, in that if you watch the confirmation hearings, any time in the last, oh gosh, how many years? 30, 35.
Yes, at least.
I can remember as a teenager watching the confirmation hearings for Rehnquist. And him getting questions like this. And by this, I mean questions about how would you rule in such and such a case. And of course, the judges, if they're smart, always say, well, I don't know. I don't know the particulars of the case. And so what you get is a dance where senators who run the hearings, remember this, it's with the advice and consent of the Senate by the Constitution. Yes. Senators spend their time dancing around attempting to find the judicial philosophy of the candidate, and the candidate spends all his time dancing around attempting to hide his judicial philosophy if he is a conservative, or shall we say a strict constructionist, because a case law approach, a liberal, gets a free pass every time. Every time, Barry. Unless he is such a screaming member of the Communist Party, he can't be he can't help but be confirmed.
Oh, you mean liberals such as Robert Bork and Harriet Myers and so you know, well, those liberals.
Well, yeah, think about it. Robert Bork is a prime example. Robert Bork was more or less a strict constructionist. He has said some things since he failed in his confirmation hearings that have made me question whether I really wanted to be in support of him or not. But the fact is that, now, Harriet Myers was sort of a, let's get the facts out here. Harriet Myers was an enigma. She was a non-entity. She was not a great legal thinker, shall we say. That was a payoff. And I think George W. Bush was thinking in terms of David Souter. Nobody knew anything about her record, and therefore they passed him without knowing anything about his judicial record, and he has turned out to be an absolute disaster.
Yeah, it was a disaster on the... That's absolutely true.
Because if you recall, who appointed David Souter?
That was George H.W. Bush.
That's right. Bush 41 appointed him. And he appointed him after the whole Bork. Now, if I recall right, Bork was appointed by Reagan. Is that correct?
Yes, he was.
And, of course, it didn't fly. And then there were a couple of, if you recall, there was a Ginsburg that came before the current Ginsburg who didn't make it because he had, as a college professor, smoked marijuana, of all the ridiculous things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got Anthony Kennedy, who has been a complete free spirit, shall we say, on the court. So this is what you get, ladies and gentlemen. We knew exactly who Sonia Sotomayor was when she was appointed to the court. We knew exactly who Elena Kagan was when she got appointed to the court. And these people got confirmed in the 90s. They got confirmation votes in the 90s because the Republican philosophy has been give them their justices, as if supposedly this is going to clear the way for Republican conservatives to quote unquote get their justices. It never happens. Never.
Well,
and that's the bottom line.
And Chuck, you hit on something right there that just amazes me to no end. There seems to be a philosophy among Republicans that, well, you know, we have to play nice while we're in the minority, because when we get into the majority, they'll return the favor. The leftist brats will play nice with us and give us what we want. Now, you know, Chuck, I've always said that there's a big problem out there in general in the philosophy of society, and that we forget the first basic rule, and that is man's basic nature. Man's basic nature, we learn from Scripture, is not good. It is evil because of the fall. And folks, it's even more so when you compound the fall with the absolute rejection of God and His Christ and Christian belief. In other words, those who are pagan or who hold to false gods, the evil is just that much more compounded. So to have a group of people sit there and say, but we'll be nice to them because we know they'll be nice to us when we get in power, is a fool's errand, Charles.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what, Barry? I hate to tell you this. We're out of time. Let's go on tomorrow.
Okay. Because there's a lot more to be delved into in this particular area, especially considering what has just occurred at the United States Supreme Court from a quote-unquote conservative justice.
Exactly. Okay, join us again tomorrow where we'll continue this discussion on principles and policies.